Because some journeys are better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Good evening to you, Francis, and thank you for joining us this evening.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Only a pleasure. Francis, so, I mean, it's always been, I guess, when we talk about any relationship between, whether it be between two nations, people from a particular country, or basically two distinctive groups, it's always ambiguous. It's always something that is very complex, ultimately. But then, obviously, COVID-19 came along last year. The virus was first detected in Wuhan in China, and it led to some weird implications globally, where the Chinese community found themselves being the subject of discrimination and stigma and all kinds of weird things at that time. What was it like during that period, about a year, if not a little more than a year ago?
Just let me correct some factual item there, Chris. And that is that the COVID was first advertised from China. But there were actually signs of COVID in countries such as Italy long before that. And also in a place called Fort Detrick in the U.S., there were COVID-like symptoms that were reported from that medical facility. You know, and if you go and check that on Google, you'll see that there's a complete shutdown of information coming from that source. But okay, to go back onto your question, since COVID occurred, you know, there's always been this relationship since Nelson Mandela came into power and he officially recognized the People's Republic of China as the people government and established ties. There's always been this relationship between China and South Africa. And, you know, even prior to that, there was a relationship between during the apartheid era when South Africa weren't able to access trade routes, or there were trade sanctions or trade embargoes in place on the apartheid regime. There was always ways that the Chinese government, not the South African government at the time, could circumvent that by accessing trade with countries that are friendly to South Africa. Like at that time, it was the Taiwanese government, and then there was also the Israeli government and a few other German government. They were all doing business with South Africa despite the sanctions. So this relationship, as you say, very complicated one. To answer your question directly, though, the current relationship is built on two pillars, and that is the BRICS, because South Africa is one of the co-signatories to the BRICS arrangement. And then also because of the new initiative, the new Silk Road initiative called the BRIC, the Belt and Road Initiative. So during the COVID, although there was a lot of negative sentiment towards China, the relationship between South Africa and China was still very strong. And in fact, during the time that China was going through a crisis, it couldn't manufacture enough masks and other PPEs during the time. So they first had to see to their crisis. And it was even a few Chinese associations in Johannesburg, in South Africa, that raised money to buy masks and send them to China. And of course, the Chinese government were very grateful for that. But in return, when they were up and running and there was enough masks that were manufactured in China to serve the whole community, they were exporting PPEs or donating PPEs to the South African government. So that has always been very good in terms of a relationship point of view. And then now recently, the Chinese vaccine, the Sinovac, which has proved to be quite successful despite some nasty press around that. It was recently tested 90-odd percent effective in some European country. I forget which one. But that is being now shipped to South Africa. South Africa at the moment, I think we're on about a 5% vaccination rate. So 5% of the South African population of about 60 million people have been vaccinated, which means that is about, what, less than 3 million people being vaccinated. Now, we know that the official figures that have been released show that there's about 2.5 million vaccines that's already been approved and shipped on the way to South Africa. So that almost double the amount of people that have been vaccinated here in South Africa. So I would say, you know, the relationship between China and South Africa is still very strong after COVID.
So, of course, there's always, you know, at that macro level between two nations, you know, the relationship between two nations, and then, of course, the interpersonal relationship between people. And I guess that in itself is also very complex, because obviously we have many people who are, you know, of Chinese descent, who were born and for generations have been living in South Africa. Simultaneously, you have people who have moved from China very recently in South Africa. What are relationships like between locals and Chinese people, generally speaking, and even within those broader categories, considering that there is no such thing as homogeny just on the basis of race or origins?
No, that's a very good question. It's very difficult because of the different regions they come from. The Chinese that have been here for the past 100 years, that have settled here, they are mainly from the southeastern part of China called Xinde. And basically the old Canton province, they are all settled here for like the last 100 years now. The new immigrants are from places like Shanghai, Fujian, you know, and so therefore they're speaking a different language completely. The Chinese writing is universal throughout China, but the Chinese language is divided into, I would say, mostly Mandarin-speaking Chinese and Cantonese and other dialects of Chinese. So the communication is very difficult to foster like very firm relationships. But you know what? The big unifier in all of this, as we've discovered in South Africa during the World Cups, which we won, has been sport. You know, and so they, through sport, people who can't speak the same language still play together and are able to communicate, whether it's in broken English, they are still able to do so. So that is a unifier. And, you know, I play table tennis and we play at the Mandeville Club up in Johannesburg, so you wouldn't know where that is. But it's a club for handicapped people. But the Chinese play table tennis there twice a week. Before COVID, this was quite an active club. And you have Chinese from all walks of life. You have the Taiwanese, you have the mainland Chinese, you have the old Chinese that have been here for a while, you know, and people of all different types of Chinese backgrounds and historical origins come together and play table tennis there. And then also our association organizes the Chinese associations combined every year. They have something similar to what they call the Maccabi Games. It's called the Easter Tournament, and it's a provincial tournament, so all the Chinese from all the different provinces compete in a whole range of sports like basketball, soccer, golf, table tennis, of course, volleyball, to name but a few. So on that level, certainly all Chinese and all, again, from all different backgrounds and historical origins, come together and play together and form relationships, which are not easy because of the language, but nonetheless, those relationships are formed. On a more official level, the leaders of our communities are always in touch with the leaders of their communities. So they give us a lot of credibility for the fact that we've been here for such a long time. They give us a lot of respect. And we, in turn, open the doors for them to our functions. We attend their functions, they attend our functions. So I would say, you know, over the next generation or two, once everybody speaks English, I think it would be a common denominator in getting more unified than we have been before. And it's always, you know, we have been here for 100 years, so our English, we speak English quite fluently. And so they will also one day be like what we were 20, 30 years ago, and they will also speak English quite fluently. Their offspring, the third generation, will mingle quite easily with our generations, I think, to come.
I mean, that's quite stunning to hear that level of collaboration. And I guess that's what happens, again, with people with common origins, but, you know, that there's a generational gap, a generational shift historically. And, I mean, we understand that there is a historic reason behind that. But at the stage between then the Chinese community and the local South African community, what are relationships like also there? And what I mean by, and I guess it's silly for me to say the local South African community, non-Chinese people and Chinese people within the South African context, what is the relationship like there?
I think it used to be very insular. You know, during the apartheid era, you weren't really encouraged to go out and mingle with other race groups. You know, you were confined in South Africa, a city like Gqeberha, I'm not pronouncing it correctly, Port Elizabeth before.
You know, Gqeberha. Gqeberha.
So that city, I grew up in that city. I went to school there and I went to university there. You know, the Chinese there were confined to certain areas, one area, due to the act called the Group Areas Act, where Chinese had to stay in certain areas, Indian people had to stay in certain areas, and that was how it was. So you weren't exactly, there wasn't actually a conduit for you going out freely and mingling with other races. But times have changed. I mean, since apartheid, people go to school from a young age, they intermingling with people of other races, other South Africans of other races, and they're getting used to that. They go to varsity and they intermingle with these people. They become friends.
Mm.
They each other over for bribes. They go to work and they intermingle in the office with people from different racial backgrounds. And so it's a much easier environment now to mingle. And a lot of the younger Chinese, you know, in those days during the Group Areas Act, we were almost forced to stay together as a Chinese. So people went to a Chinese school. You know, people played sport in the Chinese-only club, you know.
Mm.
Whereas now, the youngsters that are coming through, this next generation, they are probably more integrated as South Africans than anybody else, you know, more so than our generation. But our association, and I think in the beginning you called us the South African Chinese Association, we actually called the Chinese Association of Gauteng. And we are the oldest Chinese association here in South Africa. So in our constitution, it is written and it's one of our principles that we actually do foster relationships between other race groups and not become too insular. And, you know, we're part of South Africa, so it's not like we are a little bit of China in South Africa. We actually all aspire to be recognized as South Africans. We want to be part of the Rainbow Nation. And often we're left out. We always hear, you know, on television or radio when they advert and they tell us about our Rainbow Nation and they say the whites and the blacks and the and they never mention the Chinese. You know, we never mentioned as though although we've been here 100 years, we never mentioned as though we're part of South Africa. Now we can also say, well, maybe we're partially to blame. We have been too insular for whatever reason. But certainly the new generation of Chinese are more integrated in society, I think, than ever before. You know, we work together with other associations like Nelson Mandela Fund, you know, and a few other charitable organizations. We do try, especially during this time, to give back to the community when we're in a position to do so. So it is part... it happens informally and formally. I think informally it happens because, as I mentioned before, you know, people are mingling together at a younger age. But it also is a conscious effort of the leadership in the Chinese community, the local Chinese community, and the new overseas Chinese community to recognize that they are part of South Africa and they had better participate as South Africans.
Yeah. It's important. I mean, one of the, you know, in my working history, I worked with refugees, and there are some communities that integrate very well, other communities that don't integrate as well. And those were generally communities that tended to find themselves exposed to a lot of xenophobia and a lot of attacks and, you know, sort of the first target, for lack of a better term. And I mean, one of the key things that we tried to work on was that sense of social cohesion. And the only way that you can really establish true social cohesion is if people learn from each other. We get to know each other and understand each other from weird into idiosyncrasies around culture, religion and food, all the way to, you know, language and just, you know, sort of that learning exchange. And if I'm not learning from you, you're definitely not learning from me, and there's a high probability that at some stage there will be conflict and unnecessary conflict. So I guess it is an important issue. I mean, what are some of the programs in place to foster that sense of social cohesion and people, you know, getting together and getting to know each other?
So the charitable drive, you know, we have an association within our association called the Chinese Women's Federation, and they interact with a lot of other charities of other races where they assist, you know, impoverished people, and they establish, you know, donations for these associations. So they work together on those fronts as well. Yeah, so there's a lot of that going on from the Women's Federation side. They're building those bridges between other race groups, you know, on a basis of charitable works. So they're doing a wonderful job on that front.
No, that's very good. And I mean, that really does foster it. Look, the one thing that comes up, and I mean, Francis, I don't know if, you know, I don't want to throw the world's problems on your shoulders or basically the whole of China's relations with the African continent on your shoulders. But I mean, ultimately, that's what we're discussing tonight. And one of the key things that comes out, that's a talking point regularly, is the notion that you know, China is the new colonist. Neo-colonialism, right? And we know that, and I've had the privilege of being able to travel to numerous other African countries, and I've seen levels of Chinese business involvement at different levels, right? From Malawi to Angola to Zimbabwe to, you know, Kenya, Ghana, and there is a presence. Every flight I've been on, you would see, you know, Chinese people going to these various countries or being in those particular airports, doing business, et cetera, et cetera. What's your take on this notion and this idea of Chinese neo-colonialism in Africa?
Okay. My take, and this is me from a personal point of view, and also so you can get a Chinese perspective of all the other stuff that's been published in the Western press. But, you know, to accuse someone else of being a colonist comes very rich when you were there before and you were the colonist. You know, so I like to look at, you know, Chris, it's very difficult to disguise outcomes. You can disguise your intentions. And by that, I use an example of someone going for a job interview and saying, you know, I'm a very diligent, hardworking person, and I'm very conscientious and have a high work ethic. And after three, that's the intention. So that can be disguised. In a couple of weeks' time, when they find out that he's arriving late at work every day, you know, and he's leaving work very early, you know, and then suddenly the outcome actually tells you what kind of person he is, you know. So if you look at these people that are accusing China of colonialism, the track record isn't great. I mean, they were there. They took all the minerals out of South Africa. You know, a country like Belgium has got no mineral wealth and has got no other wealth, you know, and yet they're one of the richest European countries. You know, they have higher per capita income than the U.S., and how is that possible? You know, and I see now they're making reparations to Congo. They're making war reparations to Congo, which Congo will readily accept in their billions. But I mean, I'm saying the track record isn't good. When they were there, those imperialist countries, they didn't build infrastructure. They just took the minerals out. They even made no infrastructure. They even made infrastructure worse so that it was a barrier to entry of other conquerors that might come along and access those mining routes. So, you know, now you look at China, and what has China done? China has built infrastructure. Suddenly you see hospital schools. In Ethiopia, it used to take 3 days to get from the rural districts to the center of town where you could sell your goods, your produce. The Chinese built a railroad system that takes 6 hours to get there instead of 3 days. Can you imagine what that does to the farmer selling fresh produce? You know, the roads in Ethiopia were so bad, and it used to be flooding. So to get to the town would take you that long, 3 days. By that time, your produce is probably not as fresh as it should be. What a big economic difference it makes to have this infrastructure. Now, you can say Africa will have its time. Africa will have its time when it has its infrastructure. And the Chinese are trying to export their success story to the rest of Africa. What happened in China under Mao Zedong was that, as an hard-nosed communist, China suffered universally all over. Under Mao, China was poor universally. So you shared everything equally, but all the countries of China, all the provinces of China were equally poor. And then Mao passed away in 1976, and Deng Xiaoping took over. And Deng Xiaoping opened the markets to the rest of the world. And Deng Xiaoping's philosophy was, let's not be stupid and allocate resources so that we're poor all over. Let's allocate some economic zones. Let's do some economic rezoning of about 7 cities in China and use that as a roadmap for success. And these cities were all positioned near very fertile farmlands or otherwise manufacturing hubs. And these became the big ports of China. Like Shenzhen is a major example, virtually the Silicon Valley of China. You know, so from a simple little fishing village, this Shenzhen has been transformed to one of the success stories economically of China. You know, so China is thinking of doing the same thing in Africa. Forget about what you read in the Western press, because they have this way of describing China from a narrative of something sinister and something evil and something that, you know, you can't be trusted. But there might be another narrative, and the other narrative is China is trying to build trade partners. It cannot trade with someone that has a very low income or per capita income, but it can certainly buy the loyalty and the trade from a country that has, if all of Africa has its time, and I firmly believe that in the future, Africa will have its time. You know, China were in exactly the same situation Africa was about 30 years ago when it was poor, and it was a poor country, but they pulled themselves up, they developed, but it had to take a will from the government. It had to take them building infrastructure. It had to take them building partnerships with major corporations in the world, and then not just letting them come and take the minerals out of the ground, building some partnerships where there's a skill transfer involved and some technology transfer involved. You know, so the Chinese companies would still maintain 51% of a really successful conglomerate that took over or stood up base in China and had access to the huge market there. But in return, it upskilled its civilization, it upskilled its population, it upskilled its workforce to the point where it was a productive workforce. It wasn't a workforce that was hungry and unskilled and unemployable. You know,
so if I can just come in there quickly, and I hear what you're saying, and obviously we think anyone that has any sense of international news, international media, any sense of not being purely parochial and looks outside of the world, sees this the success of China as a nation state, right? I think that what the big question ultimately becomes, and I'll come back to something that you said right at the beginning of that last question that I asked you, but I think the big question for most people is, what is the quid pro quo? Going back to your example of Ethiopia, the infrastructure is in place. It does definitely improve the market, but ultimately, how does one state invest in another? I mean, I'll use another example that comes to mind, Lilongwe, Malawi, right? On my way to the airport early in the morning, my last trip to Malawi, and there's a Toyota Land Cruiser police vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. And clearly written on the back, donated by the Chinese government. You see what I'm saying? And it's great because now you have a police vehicle in, and then people think that, Lilongwe is the capital city of Malawi, extremely poor, very under-resourced, and that makes all the difference with those Land Cruisers that were donated for the police service so that they can better do their job. But the question is, what is the quid pro quo? What are you getting out of it? As a government, why would you invest so heavily in other countries? What is the return ultimately?
The return must be, and I'm just surmising from, who am I to actually make judgment on behalf of another country? But I'm saying, if I look at this, and I studied economics and development economics at university, so if I look at this, the only, the Chinese mentality is not to think of something in terms of a 1-year or 2-year plan. You know, American governments change every 4 years, so they can only think of 4-year plans. But I mean, the Chinese think of 20, 30-year policies. And they're thinking that in time to come, the next big growth area, like China evolved, can be Africa, and that will be a huge trading partner for China. And also, it also gives them access to, you know, China's got 1.4 billion people to feed. Mm. So China needs to access agricultural, to access food markets. It has developed all the southern parts of China now. There are a lot of cities you've never even heard of that have developed like tenfold or even a hundredfold.
Mm.
And so there are other parts of China that need developing, more the western parts of China, which is largely desert areas or unarable land type areas. But
And massive urbanization also within China, where many people are moving away from the rural areas towards cities, or some of those rural areas turning into cities.
Yes, that's also true. And that creates its own social economic problems, because you have left behind a granny and a grandfather tending to the farm and no other laborers around. You know, so, and then who looks after them when they get older and older and not able to look after themselves? So those are social economic problems that China has, together with the one China policy, which means there aren't always three or four other siblings left behind on the farm to look after the old folks. And China's changing in that regard as well. You know, they're allowing more than just the one child policy now. It's a difficult situation for them as well. It's not a easily manageable thing going forward.
Mm. And looking at that then, so clearly China's looking at its own national interests into the future. It's trying to establish trade partners. What role does China see itself playing? Because I guess, ultimately, when you have a global player, a massive global player in the global economy, like the US, there's a lot of suspicion that comes with it. And I guess it's because of history. Again, South Africa, for example, has a very ambiguous relationship with the US. And I think so does the rest of the world. We've seen a lot of interference. We've seen a lot of good, but also a lot of bad coming out of the US. And I guess the key question for many people is, what is China's perspective and vision in its relationship with partners? Is it a relationship of equality? Is it a relationship of imposition?
I think you've got to look at what the American narrative is and say that China's will be exactly the opposite. China is not out to conquer the world. You know, if you speak to people in China, and I go back to China once before COVID, I was going 2-3 times a year back to China. You know, I have a family back in Shunde, and they never, when I go back to China, and they came out to South Africa twice, you know, and they go back freely to China, like hundreds of millions of Chinese travel all over the world. And if, you know, the Chinese government was this evil government that everybody perceives them to be, or the Western press perceives them to be, then why would these 100 million people freely go back after they come to other parts of the world for holiday? You know, so one has to look at that. To answer your question more directly, I don't think China has the same priorities as someone like the United States, you know, who have always tried to be number one. They like to be in a dominant position to enforce their policies that don't even work very well in their own country down onto other countries around the world. Never mind China. China just wants to trade like it's done thousands of years ago. It just wants to trade, and it wants as many trading partners, and it wants as many win-win situations as possible, because in doing that, it grows its own economy.
Ultimately, it's then, you know, you're saying that the U.S. is always looking to be number one, whereas China is looking at a sort of a global upliftment. So everyone sort of needs to come along this journey, because if everyone else is poor, then, well, you can't become wealthy yourself. I mean, it sounds extremely noble, but let's look at the diplomatic relations then. I mean, China has a very, you know, interesting space within the global, political space in terms of human rights interpretations and understandings of human rights and so on and so forth. Do you think that that's a misunderstanding? Do you think that we just don't get China, that it's a separate system, people are happy there, or that it's a case of...
Let me first start off by saying China is no angel. You know, I mean, no country is. We all have our faults. But everybody that accuses other people of human rights have in fact themselves been guilty of human rights transgressions. And I'm talking about the U.S. themselves. I mean, how many other countries in the world have they bombed? You know, they talk about how the human rights issue amongst the Uyghurs and how badly the Chinese treat them. You know, the Uyghur population has almost doubled in the last year. So if you were really practicing some kind of genocide on them, surely they would be wiped out, like they wiped out the American Indians. You know, like the Australians have decimated the Aborigine population and subjected them to now like not a prison camp, but like a labor camp. You know, so these countries that are accusing China, Japan accuses China. Japan is one of the worst contraventions of human rights during Nanking. You know, there's pictures all over social media, and these are not doctored pictures. These are historical photographs of, you know, bodies that were massacred and beheaded, Chinese civilians that were massacred by the army. So I don't think any, and this is all adage, Chris, where you point the finger at someone and there's three fingers pointing back at you. So don't preach to China. China is no angel. We all can concur that they may have had some transgressions in the past, especially during the Mao era. But, you know, it's cruel or it's unfair to demonize one country for whatever reason, whatever your intentions are. It's not fair to demonize one country when you yourself have a skeleton full of cupboards.
So on that basis, looking at, you know, the way forward, what then happens with China, its human rights track record, the criticism that it has received thus far? Are we seeing improvements? Are we seeing changes? Are we seeing some form of liberalization around these rights? Or is it forging ahead and maintaining things? I mean, China has changed a hell of a lot, as you pointed out, from where it was in, you know, starting back as far back as the 1970s to where we find ourselves today. Do we see growth and liberalization in other spaces politically from a human rights perspective soon rather than later?
I think I can only account my own personal experiences when I go back to China. You know, and what I see there is not an unhappy group of people that's wearing grey overcoats like during the Mao era, you know, and not able to choose what they want to do. The majority of the Chinese people are more worried about making a living than playing politics or you know. I mean, you talk about 1.4 billion people. There's about 100 million people that belong to the Chinese Communist Party. So what happened to the other 1.3 million people? They are too busy making a better living than they ever had before because of the economic opportunities that has come around. You know, they are too busy doing that than to worry about. And, you know, in terms of human rights, the Chinese government, you always hear about accounts of them oppressing their civilians. I don't know. I'm not staying in China permanently, so I can only judge by what I see. What I see there is, there is a tremendous investment in public works. In other words, I see the pavements. I see how they widen the pavements. So in the evening, the old people can take walks. The young people can ride on bicycles. The joggers can jog in the street without the traffic having to overcome them. You know, I see a lot of, in the cities, I see a lot of man-made tree plantations because they're trying to provide better oxygen into the cities. You know, from the airports, you drive all the way to the major city centers. There are huge plantations of trees lining either side of the freeways. But I don't see any Western press reporting about that. You know, I don't see that. They don't get credit for that. You know, China now, in terms of COVID, the primary concern of the Chinese government wasn't to go on a platform and preach to the rest of the world. Their primary concern was the welfare of their citizens. And so, that you might call it a draconian measure, but they cut off cities completely. And even now, when there was outbreak in Guangzhou recently, you know, they were suddenly, they had the whole city in 3 days, they had the whole city tested. That's unheard of, Chris. It's unheard of. But it shows you that there's a government in place, and if, you know, granted, there was corruption in China in the past, the new leader has wiped out a lot of that. You know, and in China, they don't play. If you found guilty of corruption, you face a firing squad. It's treason. You know, it's not like you may or may not go to prison and you establish a commission of inquiry, and then the files get lost and the evidence gets lost, and you don't end up in prison for the crimes you commit. You know, and I don't know. I think South Africa can take a leap out of that book. It's to really get rid of corruption and put people in power. You know, when I was working, Chris, I worked with a lot of black graduates, and I had such high hopes for this country. I said, this is the future leadership of South Africa. If these young graduates that actually have got, you know, a mind that can discern, to reason, and this will be the future leadership. That was a good 30 years ago, Chris. These guys are still not in the leadership of the governing party. In the governing party, you have people that should not be there. They can't do their jobs. And we saw this during the recent riots. The people that are sitting in parliament, what are we paying them for? You know, what have they done? So it's the same. I'm saying the same thing. South Africa needs to go through what China goes through. Put a leadership, a strong leadership in place, strong-willed people that will actually remove people that are just drawing money from the state and not drawing salaries from the state, from the taxpayers, and not doing anything for the country at all.
So let's look at that. You know, you have a political system where you have one dominating party within China, right?
Yeah.
In South Africa, we have, you know, whether the opposition likes me saying this or not, the exact same situation. But what is the difference then between the Chinese model versus South African model, where from all accounts, from based on what you're saying, you have professionals going into, into leadership positions, creating the type of policies, creating the type of laws, creating the environment for China to you know, grow into a gargantuan economy and a powerhouse on the global scale. How did you guys manage to do that? Because it could be easy for any person in power to be held to account, and not held to account, but sort of held beholden by whichever political party and his comrades around him.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, because there's a lot of talk that maybe the stamping out of the so-called corrupt was also elimination of the opposition bodies that were not aligned to him. You know, so that is also a consideration. I'm just saying, you know, for me, a country of 1.4 billion people, South Africa's got 60 million people. You know, so what system do you put in place to manage 1.4 billion people? The only system that works has to be a form of benign dictatorship. That will work for a country of 1.4 billion people. If you think I'm wrong, look at the opposite. India, also 1.4 billion people. A democracy. But it hasn't helped the impoverished people of India. You know, so South Africa needs that. South Africa needs a strong leadership. And even because we have, and I think any third world country with a large population mass that are not educated, you need a benign dictator. But instead, we end up with, you know, the other side of the scale.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a very difficult one for me personally. I mean, as I'm sitting here pragmatically and I guess practically speaking, the easiest way to do it is, as you're saying, having that strong man in power that sort of calls the shots, and I'm not beholden to the party. The party is beholden to me, and we have this clear vision, et cetera, et cetera. But the key question then that remains, and I guess we don't have to necessarily debate it in the next 13 minutes that we have left in each other's company, Francis, is what happens if that man then decides that he wants to do things for his own benefit? How is he held to account? And that for me is the difficult bit.
Because I also know what you're leading up to, and that is power corrupts, and ultimate power corrupts ultimately. So you that will still be seen in China, what happens down the line. But for now, they're doing the right things. You know, the 800 million people that were raised out of poverty, you know, they're very happy with their government at the moment. You know, and the ones that are still going to be raised out of poverty are waiting expectantly. You know, whereas in a lot of countries that, I mean, the role model is not maybe China. The role model is maybe Singapore, the benign dictatorship, you know, where the most educated man in the country became the state president. And they got this meritocracy going, you know, not like the U.S. where anybody can become president, as we've seen over the last 4 years, you know. So the challenge is that it's actually getting the buy-in of people to say, or getting someone strong enough to say, look, I'm taking charge, you know, and this is how it's going to be. And it's not going to be government by a party for the sake of the party. It's not going to be like the U.S. where, you know, Republicans and Democrats fight each other, and the rules or policies that should be put in place for the benefit of the country falls by the wayside just because of the political infighting between two parties who should have been elected there for the benefit of the citizens.
For sure, I hear you. And I guess that's the inconvenience of robust politics, because that's what gets in the way. But, you know, there's, as I said, that's a very lengthy divergent debate altogether. I'm sure you will agree with me on that one, because then we what it turns into, it's a debate about political schools of thought and how things work, etc., etc. I mean, very quickly, beyond the politics of itself, let's look at the economy. What does the South African economy need for it to grow? Maybe not at the level of the Chinese government, but where do we need to start placing our focus?
So what is your major problem? Your major problem is unemployment, right? There is a major problem with unemployment. It created the social and economic problems that led to the unrest. So the unrest, you can blame starving people. But, you know, what do you do when you're starving? The situation is a symptom of what is wrong social and economically in your country. So the country must be able to provide jobs and provide education and upskilling of these people. So you talk about a high unemployment rate, but if the people are not employable because they don't have the skill levels, how do you correct that problem? So there's a big, I think there's a big need for this government to upskill its population and to form, like China did, form some partnerships with multi-corporations where there's a transfer of skills, where there's a almost mandatory transfer of skills, so that in years to come, you know, the company, the people that are in that company are South Africans that are owning the company. The thing of this South Africa that we export minerals to other parts of the world, and now we have high mineral prices. So now all the mining houses are making bumper profits, and no other parts of the economy are. You know, those are temporary successes. Tomorrow the iron ore price could drop. So you want to be able to. And this is something I know they recognized this years ago, but they haven't done it. And that is not to export primary source materials, but actually to export goods that have been refined already. So don't export the steel to China or to anywhere else. You know, export knives or export stainless steel items that are manufactured here, and that could create jobs when there are factories that are around that can do this.
Chinese labor practices versus those of South Africa, I mean, very different. And really, I'm not just shooting out a blank allegation of cheap labor. But I mean, if you look at what happened now recently with our public servants, the wage bill, the president and the minister of finance and everyone else coming out very early on at the beginning of the year, telling us that, listen, we don't have the money to give anyone an increase. And they were sitting with a 1.5% increase for public servants in any event. We have strong unions that then in turn, through, you know, a pseudo-socialist system, have a very strong alliance with the governing party. Unions have a lot of power. They have a lot of say on behalf of workers in this country. I mean, how do we then, in terms of our own labor practices, build on our economy, improve our economy?
So the labor practices are a function of how strong our unions are. You know, it doesn't make sense to me that we have one of the such a huge unemployment rate and the unions are still so strong. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's a contradiction of terms. You know, it should be. And whenever you hear wage negotiations, you hear them say, you know, we want 20% or we want 15% increase in wage. I've never heard a salary negotiation where they say, together with our 15% demanding increase, we will also boost production. We also commit to boosting production of this company by 10%. I've never heard that. You know, it's like, why should it only be a wage negotiation? No, I think if I was a CFO of a company, let's say a manufacturing company in South Africa or any type of company, I would say, forget about across-the-board 15% increase. I'll give my best workers 25% increase, and I'll give the ones that are doing nothing, that are poor workers, a 0% increase. You know, if we are in a situation where we have such a high unemployment rate, why are people going on strike? You know, if you're not happy and you back your own skills, go and find another job. Don't go on strike.
So China also, and this is my final question for you, and because we're running out of time, unfortunately, but China also had a history of, whether it be Manchuria, whether it be various regions of China and different peoples, including people from Asia, you know, there was a serious problem with colonization and oppression and all kinds of things within China. How did you guys overcome those issues, whereas it still seems to be a massive burden holding back, you know, from whether it be political debate, whether it be socio-economic backlash of it? How has China been able to move past that?
I think what people don't realize is that the communist government of, say, 30, 40 years ago is not the government that it is. It's, first of all, it's moved more in terms of economic freedom and capitalism. It's actually more of a capitalistic model in certain respects. And also, from a hard-nosed communist regime, it's actually become more socialist. So it's really about the government wanting to do the best for its citizens. And when they realize that, it's amazing all the other secondary issues disappear.
Mm-hmm. Because the thing is, I mean, we look at questions around innate privilege. We see the divisions within South African society today. I mean, was it as expressed within China? Are there clear divisions between the haves and the have-nots? Is there a simmering dissatisfaction there that has to be dealt with, or has it been dealt with through other means?
No, these are problems that are common to all countries to a lesser or greater extent. I mean, in China, they are the billionaires. You just need to get a contract for supplying toilet paper to a local school in China. You know, if you do that, and you know how many pupils there are, and or how many schools there are in China, if you will easily become very wealthy. But if you don't have access to that, if you are someone working on the fields, growing rice every day, you don't have access to that. So of course there's divisions in China between the people that are connected, you know, and that they have got the influence and they've got the right connections in terms of business and acquiring capital to actually invest and become entrepreneurs. You know, there's always that difference. And then you have the people that have no connections, no connectivity whatsoever. And that's the same all over the world, you know. It's like the old saying, it's not who you know. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And so who you know in China will get you far, and who you know in South Africa will get you far. If you don't know anybody, you're left behind on the starting blocks.
So your final thought on, you know, what we need to do in terms of Chinese-African relations? I mean, if you can sum it up for me in under a minute or so.
Okay.
What do we need for China and Africa to prosper, and as partners, more importantly?
Learn from China. Learn from China in terms of getting rid of the corruption, you know, create an environment for investment so that people have the confidence to bring money here. Upskill your local indigenous people so that they are economically independent and not doing the menial jobs, but actually high-skilled labor. There is that happening, but not to the extent that it should be happening. And I think they need to make more progress on that front.
Thank you so much. All the best to you, Francis. I think it was an enlightening conversation. I mean, it's the type of conversations I think that we need to have more often, considering that there's so many other factors that we need to unpack, so many other things that we need to discuss. All the best to you, mate. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us.
Thanks for the opportunity to express some of my views. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks. Okay. That was Francis Lai Hong. And I really actually enjoyed that conversation. I mean, it's not that we necessarily agree on every last thing, but it's interesting to get and gain those particular insights.